Okay. Thank you very much for the introduction, and thanks to the organizers for this awesome, beautiful program and conference. We'll be talking about measurement protocols for many body properties in AMO systems, which are considered to be designer quantum systems, and from JQI, University of Maryland. So the big, now it doesn't work, okay. So the big question actually that we are interested in, that I will talk about, is that let's assume that we have our designer quantum system. How do we go about characterizing these many body features in this many body system? And then how we go about measuring different many body properties? Just to be really to the point is that if we have a many body system and we want to know everything about the system, we have to do the full state tomography. But we know that that's very, very hard to do if it's possible. Sometimes it's not even possible in some systems. So are there more interesting ways to characterize and then measure them? So the talk is actually split into two parts. And both share actually in, overlapping ideas. In the first part of the talk, I'll talk about how we can measure entanglement, a protocol to measure entanglement spectrum in cold atom systems and circuit QED. This is a collaboration with these gentlemen over here. Apart from Ali Reza, all three are present at the conference, so you're welcome actually to talk to them as well. And the second part of the talk is measurement of quantum scrambling and measurement of out-of-time order correlators in quantum system. This is a collaboration between Guan Yu, Taron, and myself. So this is very simple, but I think it's kind of useful in the talk, is that if we start with the separable state, we want to understand whether this is entangled or not. The way that we do it is that we look at the density matrix, we trace over one of these spins, and we realize that we end up with a pure state. This means that actually the original state was separable. In contrast, if we start with an entangled state, for example, this one, and then we write the density matrix again, and then trace over the second spin, then we end up in the mixed state. So from this very simple example, we see that the purity of the traced over system will tell us about the original system, whether the system was entangled. So if the system was entangled, we will end up with a high entropy state. If the system was separable, we end up with a pure state. So the purity of the traced over the partially traced over density matrix will tell us about the entanglement of the original system. Okay, so this idea has been actually generalized to many body systems. That was two particle. For many spins, this has this is generalized actually to entanglement entropy. So we have been actually hearing about a couple of talks in yesterday. So I won't actually go through the introduction why entanglement entropy is interesting. In particular, there are these two cases. If the entanglement is local, then when we are doing a cut, you're basically introducing some entropy. So then in those situations when the entanglement is local, we have area law. But in the critical system, when the entanglement can be non-local, then we have the volume law. Another measure of entanglement is Rene entropy, which is defined through this expression. And these n's are integer numbers. So in particular, if n is 2, it basically boils down to the purity that we had in the first slide. Okay, and if n goes to 1, the limit of this expression will basically give us the entanglement and entropy. So working on more, like going one step further than entanglement entropy is the idea of entanglement spectrum, which is very simple to understand, is that, again, we cut the system in two. We trace over half of the system. This is actually, I think this is again. We trace over the half of the system. It's a Hermitian density matrix. So this density matrix can be diagonalized. And these eigenvalues are called Schmidt, these are called Schmidt numbers, or Schmidt eigenvalues, and we can write them either in terms of lambda or in terms of e to the minus some number. And then if you write them in this number, then we can call them actually energies, entanglement energies. And then we can associate actually a matrix to this diagonalized density matrix, and we can call them entanglement Hamiltonian. And this has been very successful in characterizing interesting many-body systems. In particular, it started with a paper by Haldane and Lee in 2008, where they looked at it as a fingerprint of fractional quantum Hall state and following works. There are some skeptics also in the community how powerful and how generalized this idea is. And there is actually a very nice review that if people are interested, they can have a look at it. On top of that, the interest in the condensed matter system, there is also some old work by Nielsen that they actually looked at this entanglement spectrum to understand how two states are related to each other. In particular, if I have one state psi and one state phi, can I go from psi to phi by some local operation and classical communication? It turns out that if I know the entanglement spectrum of these two states, if this basically, if one measures the other one, then one can go from one state to another state. So it's actually interesting from also quantum information perspective. So there has been actually, our work was motivated by a recent experiment in the group of Marcus Greiner, when they followed one of these theory proposals to measure entanglement entropy, in particular Rene entropy, which was the purity that we discussed. And then they studied actually the Martin-Sellitter 2 superfluid transition from the viewpoint of entanglement entropy. There are other platforms, circuit QED and ion traps, and our work is basically motivated by all of them, whether we can find some universal way to measure entanglement spectra. So, of course, one can generalize these proposals and proposals, similar proposals, to go and evaluate the entanglement Rene entropy, the first order, second order, third order, et cetera, and then from that get the entanglement spectrum. But it turns out to be not a very efficient situation. And as I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, full state tomography in these big systems is very, very difficult, if not impossible. So, for example, in ultra cold atoms, we're dealing with itinerant particles, and measuring doing the full state tomography is not clear. So, what can we do? Well, you can go forward. Yeah. So, our goal is to find the spectrum of a density matrix. Okay. In order to do that, let's remind ourselves how we can find a spectrum of a Hamiltonian. So if I want to find the spectrum of a Hamiltonian, what we have to do, we have to access to e to the minus iht, and then we should do what we know, the most and only powerful tool in atomic physics, Ramsey spectroscopy. So everything in atomic physics boils down to Ramsey spectroscopy. So we start with an ancilla, and we couple it to the system. And we basically look at how we let the system evolve, and then we measure the ancilla, and then by measuring the ancilla, we can look at the overlap of the wave function of the with e to the minus iht. So basically, if we basically do the Ramsey spectroscopy to find the eigenstates of H. By coupling an ancilla, letting the system evolve, and then measuring the ancilla. So that's basically the bottom line for Ramsey spectroscopy. Okay. So apart from our way of actually working it, finding density matrix, there are some interesting works, in particular by Alexia and Anna Maria, that I hope she would talk about it, but she didn't. So, okay, with this in mind, meaning that if I want to find a dense spectrum, I have to access to e to the minus iht, we follow the same principle, meaning that if we have access to e to the minus I rho t, if I can evolve a density matrix by some rho, then I have access to the spectrum of the system. And then the trick number one comes that was worked out by Sitloit and company in 2014. They said that if we have access to global swap and we have two copies of the system, and in particular, if we apply this global swap, meaning that I swap this site, at this site, et cetera, then we can simulate evolution of a system by a density matrix. In particular, if we have row one and row two, and then we apply this e to the I epsilon, epsilon being a small number, and the swap operator, swap being the global swap, then it's as if once we trace over the row two, the system evolves as if row one evolves with e to the minus I rho t. Okay, so one can actually do this in two lines of derivation. It's not very difficult. Or if you're familiar with this kind of presentation of density matrix, here we do the exchange, and then and when we trace, here we do the exchange, and we do and then we do the trace, and then this is basically gives us a commutator of row one and row two. Yes. We will. I'll explain. Yeah, that's the whole point. So here I just want to say that if I have access to the e to the minus I rho t, then we can get the spectrum. So let's see the challenges. The challenges is that we have to have this many body exchange operator, and in particular we have to have e to the I epsilon s operator. So in order to do that, it turns out that we can do this control global swap by just dispersive coupling and then doing Ramsey spectroscopy. So how that can be achieved? Let's look at the exchange or swap operator. The swap operator for these two lines, I can write them in this form, that basically each site, this is the operator related to the line one and operator to line two for each site. And the swap operator should displace these two. So this I can write it as an evolutionary operator, basically a rotation between A1 and A2. But then this we can actually write it in a different way. If we let the system evolve such that we go to this symmetric and anti-symmetric combination of A1 and A2, then this unitary operation will translate into just this unitary operation, which is just e to the I pi, the number of particles on the second line. Basically, we translate the swap operator into to the parity. So if we have access to the parity, if we can couple to the parity, then we can perform a swap operator. So let's see how we can do that. Let's assume that we have a dispersive coupling between an ancilla, which can be in state 0 and 1, and then it couples to the number of particles in the second row. Okay? So if I evolve this system for a specific time, then it gives me a conditional operation. In particular, if my ancilla is in state 1, then nothing would happen to the system. If my ancilla is in state 0, then the system will pick up some phase according to the number of particles that we have in the second row. And in particular, if we tune the time correctly, then we get this parity operator. So now the third trick is that now in the middle of this process, if we also do some infinitesimal rotation, then not only we have access to the S, but also e to the I epsilon S. So now let's put these things together. So we want to have this operation, this conditional operation, basically depending on the state of the ancilla, we would like to propagate forward or backward with rho. So in order to do that, we have the ancilla, we have two copies of the system, and then as I described in the previous slide, if we are in some state or in the other state, the swap operator will be applied to the system. And if we do it consecutively, if we do it, perform these steps one by one for very small epsilon, then we can actually simulate the evolution of the system with e to the I rho t. So remember that in the conventional Ramsey, if we do this situation and do this protocol and then measure the sigma z of this ancilla spin, it would give us rho trace of rho e to the minus I h t. In this situation, we just get a trace of rho, but evolve with the density matrix of the system. And now this Tn will be basically the epsilon times the number of steps that we took in our system. So here we have the system that we have actually n copies of the system, and then we do the control swap here. But this is not necessary. We can have only two copies of the system. We can perform the swap operator and then replenish and refresh the second copy and then do it again. So we don't actually need to have n copies at the same time. The only necessary condition is that we have to have two copies at the given time. So now the whole the summary of the protocol would be the following. Well, we have the ancilla, we couple this, and each of these blocks is made of those operations that I introduced previously. Basically a beam splitter operator, a C-phase operator, which could be achieved by a dispersive coupling, and an infinitesimal rotation on the ancilla qubit. Then once we do this, then if we measure the ancilla in the end, then we basically have this expression. So now, this expression basically tells us, this is written in the diagonal basis, these lambdas are the eigenvalues of the Schmidt eigenvalues. They appear as a frequency in this signal, and then the amplitude of the signal will be also proportional to lambda. So not only we can get the spectrum, we can find these lambdas by performing a Fourier transform on z of t, z as a function of time, but also the weight of it can give us the degeneracy of the entanglement eigenstates. So as an example, if we take a spin chain in this staggered coupling form and then perform a cut, which could be in principle implemented in an extended Bose-Hubbard model, then what one expects is that once we trace over half of the system, we have this four-fold degeneracy, which is related to these spins that are now unentangled at the boundary. Now, if we perform our protocol on the system, then this is what we should expect. This is z, the expectation value of the spin operator as a function of time, and then we see that it oscillates. If these different curves are correspond to different errors in the system, so in order to resolve better these oscillations, we have to choose a smaller step, which is basically gives you a better Trotter expansion. And if we do that, then if we take the Fourier transform, we see the following. We see that there is a peak at lambda equal 1 over 4, and then the area below this curve will basically give us the degeneracy of the system. So regardless of the epsilon that you choose, you see that you get the same area, and always these eigenstates lie at this specific point. Okay. So the experimental realization of it could be the following, using Rydberg states, where these are these copies of, this is a two-dimensional system, we have copies of the system. And the tunneling will allow us to do that symmetric and anti-symmetric basis preparation. This control atom will be an atom that will produce some Rydberg blockade. In particular, we would like our ancilla, when it's in the zero state, to do nothing to the system, but when it's in the one state, produce a dipole, a Rydberg blockade shift on all the states in our system. But now we selectively shine some light on some part of the system. Let's say that this is the subsystem that we are interested in. And this off-resonant light will induce some AC Stark shift that we heard also this morning. And if we time it, it will imprint some phase on this specific part of the system. So in order to be more specific, this is the Hamiltonian of the system. This is the Rydberg interaction. This is the coupling, and then this is the detuning. So if we are in this specific regime, we have this. We have our dispersive coupling that we were looking for. And if we time the system, in particular, if the AC Stark shift is timed like this, then if the ancilla is in the zero state, this subsystem will acquire some phase. If the ancilla is in the one state, the subsystem will not acquire a phase because of the dipole blockade, we have a very, very large detuning that suppresses that phase accumulation. One can also generalize it to 2D, that's possible. And also, that was an ultra-cold atom implementation of it. We can think of also a circuit QED implementation of it, which is now these are qubits in the one chain, and these are the qubits in the second chain. They're coupled to each other, but they're also coupled like this. So if we time it correctly, we can induce some tunneling in between them. And then now there is an ancilla that is dispersively coupled to the second row, such that it gives us this effective Hamiltonian. And we can perform the same protocol for this specific system. So that concludes the first part of the talk. I would actually like to take questions if it's possible. Or no, you don't like that. Yeah? Look at it like me. Yes.
Right there. So I mean, this parity measurement of the lower chain, I guess you need to be coupled exactly the same to every
That's right.
Qubit there.
Mm-hmm.
How sensitive is it to that? And with this implementation, do you get
So the second part of the talk would actually address that. Yes. No, it's actually, that's one of the motivations of the second part of the talk. Yeah. Yes.
So it seems like in order to get spectral resolution here, you need multiple copies of your system.
That's right.
So the question is, I could also imagine getting other information about the entanglement spectrum by doing nth order Renyi entropy by an extension of the method that's already been used. And then I could do like maxent or something to try to get out the actual eigen the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on what's better or worse?
Yeah, so that's why I briefly mentioned that it's not easy to get that. In general, if you have a distribution and you have the moments of the distribution, it's not guaranteed that you recover the original distribution. It's sometimes it's very, very inefficient process. So like one can actually look at the specific example and see actually it does not work really well. It's a sampling problem, yeah.
Do you know how many copies you need actually to achieve a certain resolution, like, and how close is it to the optimal?
So a rough number would be like 100 copies or 100 steps. So as I said, these copies should not exist at the same time. So this is, I mean, as I said, like as a number I give you, it's 100. But now how we achieve this 100 number is that you have to set what kind of energy scale or energy you want to resolve, and then what kind of error you're comfortable with for the trotterization, and then that gives you basically the number of copies. So, yeah, okay. So now, the second part of the talk was partially motivated by your question, but more generally motivated by out-of-time order correlator measurements. So we heard about this actually yesterday. If we want to see how a single spin gets entangled with the rest of the system, in the Heisenberg picture, it's actually very interesting to see it. We apply some operator over here at time zero, and then we see how it propagates in the system, and we would like to see at some point that these operators do not commute with each other. So in particular, if we look at this operator and then look at its commutation, with another operator on some site one, then the absolute value of this commutator will tell us about the propagation of information in the system. One can work out this commutator and write it in this way. And if we now write it in the Schrödinger picture, it will take this form. So specifically, if I take my state, I apply some operator, propagate it with e to the minus iht, apply operator 2, and then propagate it in the backward direction in time, and then O1 again, etc. This overlap wave function will give us the information about scrambling. Okay, so now how can we measure this overlap? if we have access to Ramsey interferometry and then forward and backward propagation in time, then we can actually measure that overlap. And I think Monica will talk about this tomorrow or on Wednesday. There is another work by Norm, Eugene, and company that actually they use two copies and they propagate forward in time. And then there was Aram Maria's talk, which was, again, only forward in time. So our take was a little bit different. Here we would like to actually couple an ancilla to a function as a quantum clock, such that it will dictate the arrow of time. In particular, the total Hamiltonian that we would like to engineer is of this type, that this is a bosonic degree of freedom that can be 0 or 1, that can be occupied 0 or 1. And this H is the Hamiltonian that we are interested in to look at its dynamic. Now, in particular, if the state of the ancilla is a 0 or 1, then if it's a 0, then this is 1, so it will propagate with e to the minus iht. But if it's 1, then it propagates with e to the plus iht. So depending on the state of the ancilla, the system propagates forward in time or backward in time. Okay. So if we can have this, then we have access to both forward and backward propagation. Now it comes another added benefit, which is actually an important benefit, which goes back to Mark's question, is the calibration and the benchmarking. So in any typical system, if you want to simulate like H by changing some detuning and then going to some other detuning to get minus H, we are not guaranteed to get the same Hamiltonian. And if we deviate, our signal will decay as a function of time or copy, et cetera. So what guarantees that that decay is actually the one that we are looking for or not just some error in the system? We are hoping that this ancilla business would actually help us to benchmark the system. In particular, make sure that e to the minus iht and e to the plus iht will clean each other, and then perform the experiment that we would like to do. So first we calibrate the system, and then let the system evolve. So I'll show how, for example, this works for this scrambling. So as I said, this is the overlap wave function between this wave function and then this. This is this basically this bracket can be written in can be split into two parts, and then we would like to do a Ramsey measurement that this part, the ancilla in state zero will generate this wave function. Ancilla with state 1 will generate this wave function, and in the end, when we measure the system, you would get the overlap of the wave function, similar to the previous part of the talk. So in particular, if we start with the system with some state and state 0, then we apply a Hadamard gate. So this is two arms of the Ramsey interferometry scheme, and this is the equivalent circuit one. You can follow each one as you're comfortable with. So we apply a Hadamard gate. We put this in the superposition. And now we apply this conditional operator. On 0, we don't apply it, but on 1, we apply it. And now we apply the propagation. But since this arm of the system is in 0, it will propagate with e to the iht, but the lower one will propagate with e to the minus iht, right? Because we assume that our Hamiltonian was of the form that I introduced, depending on the sign of, depending on the state of the ancilla, we go forward in time or backward in time. If we have such Hamiltonian, and I will describe how we can actually experimentally do it, but if we have such Hamiltonian, then application of that propagator will give us this wave function after evolution. So now we can continue this discussion. We can again apply O2, apply now. The crucial point is that we flip the ancilla spin in the middle of this process, such that now forward will become backward, backward will become forward, because that ancilla will tell the wave function how to react. So here it propagated with plus, now it propagates with minus, vice versa. Then we continue like this. At this point, the upper arm has this wave function, the lower arm has this wave function. Now, if we measure the system in the sigma z basis, then you would collapse either to L or to right, depending on the ancilla being measured in 0 or 1. But if you measure the ancilla in some perpendicular basis, in, for example, sigma y basis or tau y basis, then we look at the overlap of left and right. 4 minutes. So the implementation of it is the following. Imagine that these are my real spins that I'm interested to engineer some interesting Hamiltonian to look at them. And there is a bus qubit that actually couples this spin. And there is, on top of that, an ancilla clock that is coupled to the bus. So the action of this bus is that it mediates some interaction between my red spins. In particular, if you have some flip-flop Hamiltonian between these kind of spins, then if we integrate the blue spins, then we end up with some mediated interaction for the red spins. But on top of that, there is a dispersive coupling between the green ancilla clock to the bus clock. So more specifically, we would like to have a situation where the state of the clock will shift the frequency or the energy of this mediator spin, of this bus spin. Why this is important? Because if we are in state 0, then let's say it has this detuning. But if it's in state 1, if we have a dispersive coupling, it will shift these mediators, these spin mediators, such that now the interaction that is mediated for the red spins through the blue one has a different sign. So it can be seen very simply over here. So if we do like a second order perturbation, a simple second order perturbation in the spin bus coupling, then we see that we have this detuning in the denominator. But the detuning is nothing but the difference between the blue spins and the green spins. And now if we change it depending on the clock, then this sign will change. In particular, we would have a Hamiltonian of this type, that the effective Hamiltonian of the system will be some spin coupling with some flip-flop with Z, et cetera. But now there is a prefactor, and that's actually the prefactor that we were looking for. Okay? So now if we fine-tune the system such that the sign will exactly flip, we get this effective Hamiltonian, and then we can perform our protocol to measure the scrambling. So an example this is a simulation that was done by Taron, a simple spin chain with randomized impurity, and then we look at this correlator as a function of time, and then different curves are actually related to different kind of imperfection in the system. If we are, for example, if you have a classical switch, but our classical switch is not exactly the same, so instead of going from h to minus h, we go from h to h plus some delta characterized by this delta, then we see in a perfect system we should expect a free propagation given by this butterfly velocity, that the correlator should not fall for time t butterfly, and then after that it should fall down. But then now if we add this classical switch problem, then we see that we deviate very, very quickly from the predicted curve. So this has nothing to do with quantum scrambling or anything in the system. It's just an artifact that our switch is not perfect. And if we zoom in, actually, we can see it better. So what we would like to say here is that instead of actually doing a classical switch, if we do this quantum switch, we can apply no operator in the system. We let the system evolve, and then we propagate with e to the iht and e to the minus iht. We make sure that everything works fine and the overlap is maximized, and then we applied our O1, O2 operator, and then we see the deviation from that. So doing that, it's sometimes not very easy because you might have like 10 detunings that you have to optimize. So I'm not claiming that this actually is a free lunch and it would work for everyone. But if the number of degrees of freedom are finite, then one can actually find an optimization algorithm that would give you the maximum overlap. So then one can actually look at the implementation of it in circuit QED either all-to-all coupling that I mentioned previously, or the nearest neighbor coupling, where now the mediators are sitting in between these spins, or some 2D version of it. So with that, I would like to summarize. I talked about how to measure entanglement spectrum, in particular in implementation in cold atom systems and circuit QED. I talked about how we can measure this out of time correlators. I would like to thank my collaborators, as listed here. And many of them are actually present in the audience, and you for your attention. Thanks. If there's a there's someone in the back, way in the back. All right, sir.
So it seems that in your four-point function plot, there are so many time scales that are coming into game.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any intuition about what are these time scales?
No. No.
Because generally you have this.
No, so this is model dependent. The reason that actually I showed that plot is to just highlight that for a given model, your system, your signal can decay, not necessarily because of the dynamics of the Hamiltonian that you're interested in. It's just the imperfection of your protocol.
Oh, it's a protocol-induced oscillation.
Yes, that's right. So this delta that you have over here, so this delta was just the imperfection of the protocol. It has nothing.
What about these wiggles that are on the down?
Yeah, so these are specifics of the system. But the difference, so what I would like to say is that the imperfection of the protocol is characterized by delta. And then if we change delta, you go from one curve to another curve. Your question is that if, let's say, delta is zero, why we have these wiggles? That's, again, it's specific to this
Hamiltonian.
To this Hamiltonian. It can be a finite size effect, for example. I don't know.
So where do you put the Ehrenfest time in this?
I don't want to make a big claim over here. So the only thing that I would like to get from this slide is that here the operators do not talk to each other. So basically, it's a ballistic propagation, and then over here they start to talk to each other, and then it falls. Now, how we can characterize different times, I don't know.
So I guess big motivation for considering this out of time order correlation function is to probe chaos, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what are other ways of probing chaos, and sort of how would you compare them? Because you know, mm-hmm. you could also look at Loschmidt echo, for example,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Just how mm-hmm. the overlap.
Exactly.
Changes if you
yeah.
do, let's say, local quench of the Hamiltonian. So
yeah. Yeah.
Do you think there is a relation between the two, and what?
So it's actually a good question. So I don't want to answer the fundamentals of it, whether Loschmidt is better than out of time. I would like to come back to the claim that even for Loschmidt, you propagate with e to the iht, and then you change a little bit in the Hamiltonian, you come back with the e to the iht plus some epsilon. And again, if one performs that experiment, there is no guarantee that you just messed up somewhere in your propagation. So even in Loschmidt, it would be nice that you have access to the e to the iht, e to the minus iht. You perform this, you know that the fidelity is one or maximum, and then you add that perturbation, and then look at the decay of the signal. So what I'm arguing is that even if you want to do Loschmidt echo, experimentally, one has to calibrate the system so that you have some benchmark to start with.
It's a fundamental problem.
Yes.
So it
depends on the number of parameters that you have in the system. Okay. So if the number of parameters in the system is large, then that optimization problem can be actually as difficult as solving your problem. That I agree. But if the number of degrees of freedom that you can actually tune is small, then it's fine. Let's say everything is perfect in the system except you are detuning. Then, of course, in this very simple case, you can play with the detuning such that to make sure that you get to the fidelity one when you propagate forward and backward. But of course, if you have many impurities in the system and time dependent, etc., there is no way to track that, and that would become a fundamental problem. But if it's a static and we can detune them, then no.
But actually, when you measure something like orthogonality catastrophe, mm-hmm. right? So of course you do it in the frequency space, mm-hmm. but why is that not somehow good enough? Because it's directly related to the Loesch-Mittecker, right?
Yeah. No. Your question has two sides. That your question has a fundamental side that I don't argue with. That there might be some other ways to look at chaos in the system. The practical side I'm addressing. I don't claim that one is better than the other one, and why for a specific system is better than that. You probably know more than this. Okay. Victor.
So do you interpret this lambda in this expression that you wrote as a Lyapunov exponent of some sort?
Yeah.
And what is it? Do you actually calculate it?
I'm sure Tarun actually calculated it.
So is it supposed to follow from this data somehow? I'm a bit perplexed. What's the relation between this curve and this lambda?
This curve and this lambda. How you distill lambda from this curve?
Yes.
Then you have to look at how actually this falls over here. When for example at t0, then you have an exponential fall. But then when t progress in time such that t becomes larger than x over vb, then you will have an exponential fall off. From that you can read off lambda.
Yeah, and if,
but I don't have it here, I don't know.
If I understand correctly, so there is this interesting statement about the fundamental limit on this lambda.
Mm-hmm.
So which is basically quite temperature range bar, whatever.
Yeah.
So did you check that it's actually smaller than that? Or, I mean, is there a temperature in this calculation?
No.
So what is the state you're calculating?
So again, maybe this has produced a lot of issues. I'm not making any argument on finding the Lyapunov exponent or the butterfly velocity from this specific model. I say that if I have some Hamiltonian, and I would like to distill, and I would like to look at this out of time order correlator, then if my protocol has some problem, then I would have some deviation, regardless of the model. You will always get something that deviates from that. But for this specific model, you want to read the butterfly velocity or lambda, that's a different question.